It's the Wonky Show. The government has spoken on university funding, but did it say anything? OFS has been pitch rolling on franchising, we'll read between the lines, and there's research on digital student experience. Is the digital divide getting bigger? It's all coming up.
You know, if you want to grow the economy, then investing in skills and high-level skills is going to be one of the ways you do it. And it's really depressing that we've not made the argument that this is not an expense, it's an investment.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to write their 300 words on what they did this summer, as usual, three top draw guests. In Birmingham, Smita Jamdar is partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. Smita, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Jim, was attending the Digbeth Dining Club's summer tour at Lightwoods Park in Barewood, where I frankly scoffed an obscene amount of extremely delicious food from around the world. What could possibly be better than that?
What was your favourite bit?
Jerk chicken. It was insanely good.
I haven't had breakfast yet, so that... in York, Ben Volume is Executive Director at the Association of Heads of University Administration. That's a hewer to you and me. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
It's a boring one from me. We closed registration for our 2024 autumn conference, which is next week, with our largest turnout for 17 years, with all the big names, including Smita.
Yeah. All the big names. And in Chorley this week, James Coe is Associate Editor at Wonky. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, everybody. And my highlight of the week has to be, Jim, it is the new season of The Wonky Show. It is the start of term. We are bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and absolutely ready to go.
In other words, he's had a terrible week. So, yes, we'll start this week with Jackie Smith. The still fairly new Universities Minister has spoken to Vice-Chancellors at Universities UK conference. James, what did she have to say?
Jim, do you remember a few months ago when the OFS did that inside brief and they said providers are forecasting deteriorations in the short to medium term, financial performance is weaker than they expected, decline is going to be in 23-24, 40% are expecting a deficit. Do you remember that brief?
I remember it well, yes.
Remember it with a certain fear. Well, Jackie Smith, talking at UUK conference, the newly minted skills minister, said she will be working closely with the OFS to understand the sector's changing financial landscape and that she is committed to making sure there are robust plans in place to mitigate risks as far as possible. Warm words, however, the problem is that, of course, the banks, overdrafts, credit lines, staff redundancies, programme closure, the loss of PS staff can't wait indefinitely, and the tools to Jackie Smith's hands aren't obvious. Bailouts are politically hard, mergers are practically difficult, and it is less than ideal to see the dwindling jewel in the crown of our nation's economic fortunes get gradually and gradually diminished. So warm words, but no definitive action on a bailout of any description for the sector.
Well, let's have a listen.
Yeah, I mean, I started by talking about the financial peril that the sector faces, because as I said, that is the first thing that people said to me, and it would be wrong not to recognise that. And I also said, we are working on options. I showed a teensy bit of leg, and that was the maximum that I'm in a position to show at this moment, I'm afraid. Let me just say, in thinking about what might be possible, you absolutely, David, identified, if you like, the sort of key challenges, which is how can we support students at a time when they have been disproportionately impacted by the cost of living crisis, and in a way that promotes access, particularly as I laid out for those who, and we saw it just this year again in terms of the regional disparity in applications to university, where, you know, your ability to be able to go to university depends as much on the sort of social and regional background that you have as it does on your ability to be able to benefit from it. So how can we tackle that? And how can we ensure that there is a sustainable financial position for universities?
So there we are. So, Smita, I guess the thing here is, obviously, and we kind of knew this in the manifesto, we get a sense that there's a kind of big long-term review coming, but it's until we get to its conclusion and its implementation that everyone is panicking about, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it would be great to think we had the luxury of you know, potentially several years, if you look back to how long Augur took, to think about how to fund universities. But we really don't have that luxury. And we don't have that luxury for anybody, to be honest, because we all know that there are some universities for whom this is an incredibly pressing and urgent matter. They can't wait for years. There are students going into university now who are about to incur, you know, a large amount of liability for tuition fees, repayments, etc., which, you know, their experience is going to be diminished in the here and now unless something is done about it. And we all know, because we've, you know, been in the sector long enough to know this, that a failure of a university would have huge and profoundly negative consequences for local economies and the taxpayer and all the rest of it. So it's just not a satisfactory answer to say, yes, we're going to look at it in the long term. That might also be needed because we know that the current model is not necessarily working, but that there's going to have to be a short-term fix. And it seems to me that it's going to come one of two ways. Either government and the OFS is going to wake up to this and together with DfE, et cetera, work to plan something, or it's going to be forced on them because something big is going to suddenly look like it's about to fall over. And I mean, there are no easy answers. So it's pretty easy for all of us to sit here and say, well, this is all very unsatisfactory. But, you know, ultimately, they're going to have to do something more than just say, well, I'll show you a little bit of leg and wait for a few years.
Mm. I mean, Ben, it's difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, some people would argue that what's required here is an intervention for those closest to the edge. Other people would say, look, everyone just needs a really, you know, a modest tuition fee increase whilst we work out, you know, this kind of bigger review. And I guess some people would argue both, but it feels like neither are going to be possible ahead of a spending review and a budget.
I don't think anything's going to change ahead of a budget. I think that the budget is underpinning everything at the moment. I have to say that I think the worst case scenario would be a small nudge on a fee in isolation of everything else, because that just perpetuates a system that's broken and got us to where we are at. I think the real long-term solutions will require a conversation, you know, will require a conversation by universities and government together. We've got to share some accountability and responsibility, both for understanding how we got to where we are and for building something better, more substantial, and that isn't going to mean we're having the same argument in 12 months' time because we played around the sides of the issue. And I guess, you know, it is frustrating that we get, you know, shown a little bit of leg but no substance. But you know, there's a reason for that. It's because the spending review is, we hope, what will unlock something a bit more substantive, a bit more long term.
Jimbo, there's a separate thing that's come out of UUK this week. So Sally Mapstone quote attached to it, some London economics research. You know, the usual stuff on the economic impact of the sector. But one of her quote says, it's clear we're at a fork in the road. We can choose to have universities thrive, or we can allow them to slide into decline. And one of the things that I think is interesting about that is, like lots of stuff that comes out of UUK, it says, if we don't do X now, then what will happen next is decline. But it feels like decline is already there internally at some places, doesn't it?
Yeah, but there's two views of this, Jim. So the new LFS chair saying it might no longer be the golden age of higher education, I think is needlessly gloomy. And I think we are going through undoubtedly an extremely hard time, but there is a way to find a better future. I think the real problem is, aside from international student fees, which the government have said, we are really welcome of international students, and everyone's really relieved to hear that, there isn't any free money in which to sort out the sector's finances. So then you have to say, okay, what is the priority of spending of the public generally against all of the priorities? And what is the fairest way to distribute what is ultimately the public's money? I think raising tuition fees is hard because effectively what you're saying is that a generation who has had a tough time of universities in recent years due to COVID onwards and onwards should also shoulder additional costs for that. And I think that's quite difficult. I suspect one of the easier ways of doing it is to rebalance the teaching grant, so public funding more accurately reflects how much it costs to teach. But it would be an enormous shame if we simply let one of the few things we are exceptionally good at internationally just dwindle for the sake of what is a few billion pounds in the grand scheme of things, which pays for itself.
Smita, obviously, it's that time of year where there's lots of those articles in the newspapers about freshers, so, you know, kind of people are enrolling. But one of the things I often think about is, I guess one of the ways in which you can survive as long as you, you know, as long as you clock that, you know, your international numbers are down or whatever early enough, is you can make quite substantial cuts inside universities. It's just that you're not going to be delivering what you promised. And there are potentially all sorts of, and I say potentially, all sorts of legal questions about the sort of experience that students will be enrolling into, as opposed to what they were sort of promised when they were made the offer, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a couple of inquiries from journalists recently asking exactly that sort of question, saying, you know, what are the ramifications for students' expectations and their legal rights? And we don't need to rehearse it because we've talked about it endlessly. And I know you've written about it a lot as well, Jim, that, you know, students do have legally binding expectations based on what they've been told as to what they will get when they arrive. And we also know that students are increasingly aware of those rights, and there are certainly law firms who are increasingly aware of students' rights and you know, willing to try and advance those claims. I'm going to say something which probably is slightly counter to the legal position on this, which is, if we continue with this, you know, idea that somehow universities have to deliver exactly what they promised, they can't afford to deliver exactly what they promised because they're losing money on their teaching, other sources of income have shrunk international students, and the regulators on the case saying you've got to deliver what you promised, etc. That is not leaving any room for any kind of sensible discussion about what can we genuinely now afford with the money that is now coming in. And, you know, I know that's going to be tough. Going back to what Jim was saying, what's tougher on students? Is it being asked to pay a little bit more, or understanding that some small element of what they were promised may not now be delivered quite as it was? But they're still going to get a great experience. They're still going to get a great degree. They're still going to enjoy the next 3 years. And I do get really frustrated at the fact that we've closed off, through regulation, through legal requirements, through the funding, masses of room. There's no room for manoeuvre for universities. And then we wonder why they're not great at sorting it all out. I would not lead a university right now, no matter how much you paid me.
Ben, that gets us back to the this question of the balance between, you know, kind of private contributions and public contributions, doesn't it? Because it seems to me that if the bulk of the money was coming in from, you know, the taxpayer, then you know, to some extent, you elect who you elect collectively, and if there are cuts, there are cuts. But if you're making a personal contribution, then it seems to me that there's a much stronger right to have what you were promised.
Yes, I think I've long argued from a variety, you know, in a variety of different roles and perspectives, that the biggest concern I have with the funding system that's been established in the UK is that everybody is sat on a debt mountain and feels that they're the primary purchaser. The student feels they're sat on huge amounts of debt and why aren't I getting what I'm promised? The taxpayer feels like it's sat on a giant mountain of debt and why isn't it getting what it's promised? And now universities feel like they're sat on a mountain of debt and saying, you know, how does this add up? So everyone feels like they're the one making the primary investment and their needs should sit somehow, you know, at the very least with parity to others, if not above others. And that's always going to break. That's the problem with the system.
Jimbo, do you reckon that we actually need a proper university to go over or under or whatever the phrase is before, you know, there's an emergency intervention? Or do you think we're just going to sort of bumble along, squeeze on through, hope that lots of students don't complain about a particular set of modules being halved? Do you know what I mean? Is that where we're going to be?
Well, Jim, you're asking me, is it broken until something breaks? And, you know, if you look at the likes of Grange School of Management, which went bust how long ago? 4 or 5 years now, maybe? 6, getting on? I mean, it had a significant amount of public funding, and we hadn't learned lessons from there. I think, look, if nothing happens, an institution is clearly going to go bust. But the problem is that the ideas of, oh, we can make these large-scale savings are not free. Redundancy schemes are not free. Closing programs is not free. Anything which is large-scale has a cost to it. So the question for some might be the nature of the exit. And unless a structured regime is put in place, then there are going to be some messy exits. Or the government has to say, we're not going to let an institution fail and we will do some sort of regime. But that will involve complex reclassifying of public debt. So I don't necessarily see an easy way forward, but I think there is a risk that unless something happens, we are in an uneasy world, as Smita says, where we expect institutions to do something. And they simply don't have the levers to do it.
Smita, you'll have seen that an actual provider has closed this week, Schumacher College in Totnes. One of the things I was thinking about it, though, is that if you look at the number of students and what's happened to those students, I have no doubt that more students than that, and in roughly the same impacts, have probably been affected by some of the ways in which universities are saving money in another place. But that doesn't trigger the same kind of attention, does it? Because of the way we focus on providers rather than students in the regulation.
Yeah. I think there is sort of definite. There's something very kind of newsworthy, isn't there, about a provider closing. And it's not newsworthy to talk about necessarily a course closing or you know, modules being removed or whatever else is currently going on in the as institutions, you know, look to rebalance their finances. So definitely, and equally, there have been other providers who've kind of closed who are bigger than that, but it's just been done in a more orderly fashion. I think what was newsworthy about the latest one was just how abrupt it all seemed, and it did seem to have caught everybody, including the regulator, sort of slightly blindsided by it.
Yes, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because there's a sense in that one that there was a plan in place to go slow, and then suddenly whoever was, you know, held the purse strings wanted to go faster. Yeah. I mean,
but Jim, that is sorry to interrupt, but that is the reality of acute financial decisions. You do not have time. You know, that's the thing you lack usually. So that whole adage of, you know, how do you go bust first slowly, then really, really quickly is absolutely right. And that's what we're not geared up for at all.
Yeah. That's what to the extent to which there's a regime in place, that's one of the things it doesn't cover. But Ben, one of the things that has also happened this week that we should briefly reflect on is that Graham Day in Scotland, the minister in Scotland, has warned the sector that there could be further cuts coming. Now, Scottish budget came out this week, plan for government and so on. So far, they found savings from over-budgeting initially on student support costs. But, how much further can Scottish HE be squeezed?
Scotland has been under pressure, and I fear it's going to come under a lot more pressure, and there are difficult questions that the institution is going to be asked and are going to have to ask themselves. And you know, for a long time, there's been, you know, we've been very focused on England, but I think Scotland's under a lot of pressure here.
James, more broadly, right, once you start to think about what the options are, there aren't really many options here, are there, for a government that basically is saying, we can't really spend any money, folks, other than on really big public services where, you know, there's a public sector, you know, a pay review body, until after the next election, because we need to grow the economy between now and then. I mean, this is hard stuff. You know, one of the things I've been saying to student unions when I've been visiting is, I'm not sure there's going to be any substantial increase on anything until, you know, at least midway into the next parliament. And that, you know, that doesn't get me many smiles.
I find it hard you don't get smiles where you go, Jim. So I think
I should wear a hat.
Ultimately, the option is either institutions are allowed to fail and all the consequences that come for local economies, people's jobs and people's lives, or you find a mechanism to direct public funding that stops that from happening. Those are the only choices that are available. And I get that Labour has to rebuild the economy and that economic times are tight. But it's like me wishing for there to be less traffic and not building a road, or saying, well, I really want to get fit, but I'm not going to buy any running shoes. You can't build the economy if you break the foundation. Now, undoubtedly, there are still efficiencies to be made. I'm sure there are things that can be done around the edges. But there are some institutions who have no levers left to pull and will not be able to make it to the next election unless something is done.
Because I guess, me to back on that, you know, promises kept or not thing, you know, maybe a module catalogue of 30 goes down to 20. But I mean, if we're thinking about what happens in 6 years' time, if people have had to still cut to the cloth they've got available, we are well beyond the sort of, you know, cutting and carving that people can get away with by the time we get there, aren't we?
We are. And I think the, we've talked at various points in this conversation about, you know, not wanting to see a decline, etc. But the decline has been happening for many years. You know, we've seen subject areas cut. We've seen, you know, curriculum radically change, some of it, you know, positively, some of it in response to the finances. And I think all the easy cuts have probably been made already. I know people believe there's efficiencies out there, but I'm not convinced they're of a scale that's going to make a massive difference to the financial position. And I think it is about going back to Jim's point, which is that, you know, if you want to grow the economy, then investing in skills and high level skills is going to be one of the ways you do it. And that's not just what higher education is about. It's about a lot more than that, but it's certainly got a role to play. And it's really depressing that we've not made the argument that this is not an expense, it's an investment. And I do, you know, it depresses me that message just doesn't seem to land with Treasury and you know, get them to release the kind of controls a little bit to allow that to happen.
And it's the first budget, really, pretty much the only moment where Rachel Reeves could get away with rewriting and rewiring some of those spending assumptions and spending rules and the way that different expenditures treated and so on, I guess. Ben, I guess the other thing is, and you know, it's characteristic of the conversation we've had. It's actually characteristic of the speech that Jackie Smith delivered. She did come back to it in the chit chat, but obviously higher education both has costs in terms of delivery and then costs in terms of experiencing it. And the student support situation is pretty bleak as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, I thought it was interesting that she suggested that was in the mix as well. That, you know, that does suggest that they are looking at more, you know, a suite of financial questions, you know, rather than a single issue of, you know, how much should we increase the existing fee by. It suggests they're trying to think about the pressure on those, you know, the different parties that are investing into universities, as I mentioned. I think the one thing that really worries me and that is in my head and partly prompted by what Smita just said, colleges and schools have been through, frankly, fierce levels of austerity that universities were insulated against by the creation of fees. And there are some people who would say, you know, while I agree with Smita, there's only so much more fat left to be cut in universities. There are some who would say you haven't been through the pain that other parts of the entire education system have experienced. And, you know, so it's a kind of built-in, you know, expectation of the riches and grandeurs of higher education that we're hanging on to. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think it's a question that will be levied at universities as critical decisions are made about funding.
But James, right? I mean, I will wind it up after this. But this is doesn't that point then back to that stuff Smita was talking about, which is one of the options that universities in theory don't have is to significantly reduce the quality of the experience, because the bulk of the money comes in from individual contributions with a consumer rights thing attached to it. So, you know, the question is, why aren't universities saying to government, we can't make further cuts, folks, because if we do, we're in breach of the law?
Because a really hard and really technical argument to make, I think, is the answer. I think potentially worse than that, there is also no public appetite for increasing tuition fees. So if you want to do it, you have to really want to do it because you think it's the right thing. There's not a political gain to do it. And of course, the way it's funded, this is going against schools funding, concrete scandal in school, onwards and onwards. So I think we have to be really careful about how we message the investment element as a public good, not for the preservation for preservation's sake, because that won't cut through the public.
Well, now, plenty more analysis on all of this and more, as usual, on the site. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name is Douglas Blackstock, and I'm the president of ENCA, which is the umbrella body for quality agencies in Europe. The premise of my article on Wonky this week is simple. The UK government wants to reset relationships with Europe. Let's take an easy win. Realign English quality practice with that of the rest of Europe. and adopt the European standards and guidelines for quality. They are the bedrock for qualifications recognition in Europe, but also now globally because of the UNESCO Global Convention on Recognition. And indeed, partners in Africa and ASEAN have adopted broadly similar practice. The ESG are going to evolve, and we are heavily involved in shaping that with partners. But there are some things that won't change. The expectation that every institution has a periodic visit by an independent review team. Transparency of public reporting of quality processes. Students included at all levels of quality assurance is a non-negotiable, and the independence of quality assurance agencies. These are not hard things to fix, and I think the government should put it high up on the list of the Department for Education's priorities.
Now, next up this week, the Office for Students has published an insight brief on franchising in higher education. Ben, what's going on here?
Yeah, the OFS has returned to the vexed question of franchise delivery of higher education, saying that without appropriate oversight, there are significant risks to students and taxpayers, especially when multiple delivery partners are used, when the numbers are large, which often they are, and when franchising is a large proportion of a university's total registered students. Student characteristics data for 22-23 show that over 50% of full-time subcontracted out undergraduate students had no unknown or other entry qualifications compared to 9% overall. The OFS has said that it received reports of issues including excessive charges levied by agents, inappropriate advertising, falsified English language test scores, and lead providers being persuaded to lower entry requirements. I think, you know, really we're in another part of the pressure cooker here, where as universities try to rethink their business models in order to be more sustainable, there is going to be a need to look at elements of franchising, but that actually will increase the risks for some of those same institutions.
Smita, when I was a kid, right, from time to time we would be kept the whole school or the whole year or whatever would be kept in at over lunch in some sort of special assembly, and someone would stand at the front and say, some of you have done the following things. And we were always furious, right? Because we would look around and go, well, have a pop at them then. Have a pop at us. And I was reading it and, you know, I mean, this thing where delivery partners have persuaded lead providers to lower entry requirements for the sake of meeting targets. Staff managing partnerships at lead providers have been incentivized to prioritize recruitment and retention of students above rigorously reviewing course quality and holding the delivery partner to account. Surely we need to know who these people are, and they need to get the insight brief, don't they?
Well, I think that going back to what you know, Ben's introduction to this, I think the issue is that if you just limited it to the current problems, you're not recognising the drivers that are meaning that more institutions might start to look at this as a potential model. So yes, of course, I'm sure, and you know, the insight brief refers to the fact that there is action being taken. There are specific discussions going on with particular providers and your requirements on them to provide more information about their franchising, etc. But the truth is, we risk missing the systemic issues that are driving these kind of changes to business models. And there's two aspects to it. One is the positive aspect, which, let's face it, is what the whole of the Higher Education and Research Act was based on, which is we need new, different, innovative providers coming into the higher education sector. And clearly subcontracting is one way. And to be honest, probably, you know, in terms of financial viability from the new entrants point of view, the best way to start operating in the higher education sector. So there's that positive drive to say, well, think about what you could bring in and regional, you know, cold spots and all the rest of it. And then there is the sort of slightly more defensive drive, which is to say we need income. And this is a route to income. So I actually think it's a good thing that we've had this insight brief. I thought there were some notable changes of tone in there. There are several references to the fact that the OFS is willing to speak to people before they enter into partnerships. I've never seen anything like that from the OFS before, because it's been very much about you come to us when it's all gone wrong and we don't want to know until then. So, you know, it's not just one or two institutions. There's a lot who may be thinking about this, and it's important that they understand what's going on and the lessons to be learnt from where it hasn't perhaps gone as it should.
Jimbo, one of the things that I thought was quite stark in there was, you know, when you kind of add the numbers up, the big increase in the past couple of years has been business and management and students who share disadvantaged characteristics, actually. You know, the sense is that the big expansion here has been we have taken higher education out to huge numbers of students who, you know, normally struggle to get in. But that raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it, about what we mean when we say access and participation? Because, you know, as I've said in my blog this week, for me, you know, it's bad enough when the poor door is attached to the building, let alone when it's 200 miles away above a kebab shop in London.
Jim, can I shock you that I think two things are true here. I think more higher education is better than less higher education. And I also think, irrespective of characteristics, students deserve to have a high-quality education. I think when I read through the brief, I think there's two things that stand out to me. It is fundamentally a governance question. And if you are willing to put your name to something, are you absolutely confident that the people you entrust to deliver it are delivering a high-quality product, high-quality service that is giving what students are promised? And secondly, is this being done for the right reasons? So that right reason might be you see it as a means to expand your market share, but are you doing that responsibly? Or the right reason might be all the, you know, more benign and sort of benevolent reasons, we hope, in that it's being done for access. The worst of all worlds would be a sort of hit and hope approach, where you see constructing these type of partnerships as relatively low risk, and you hope it brings numbers in, when everything the OFS is saying in their briefing is actually contains high risks, particularly if you have high student numbers, high numbers of partners, and high numbers of students concentrated in some areas. So I hope this is a wake-up more than it is a finger wag that doesn't go anywhere.
Ben, you'll know what I mean when I say this, but both in terms of your sort of old life and now your new life. You know, when you meet people who are from fundamentally different parts of the sector or the world or whatever, right? And then they talk to each other, and often they think they're talking about the same thing, but talking at cross purposes. And one of the things I think comes through here is this sense that, you know, there's a bunch of people in traditional higher education that are, you know, focused on quality assurance and fairly benign and so on. And then a bunch of other people who are in it to make money as well as deliver education. And it feels like when you put those two together, if you're not really, really careful, the money starts to talk.
Yeah, and again, in the current economy, people are going to ask questions about the money talking, aren't they? And that, you know, it will make people nervous. I totally agree with Smita that the language has changed. This is not designed to demonize and prohibit franchise provision. It's designed to say there may be a role for franchise provision. It may support and enable and create new opportunities for institutions and for students, but you do need to build it into your institutional governance frameworks. That's about protecting, you know, your institutional reputation, but also about protecting quality of experience for your students. That should be welcomed, I think.
Smita, reading between the lines here, I think one of the predictions we might be able to make is that at some point OFS is going to say, look, you know, if you're providing HE, you've got to be on the register in that category that never emerged when, you know, the Higher Education Research Act came. I can't remember what it was, basic or something it was called. So you can look at governance. If that happens and a couple of three of these big private providers doing business and management say, right, we're off, and they could go fairly quickly, that raises then all sorts of rapid student protection issues, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And I think your point that is it viable to regulate through the lead providers at all time, or do they need some direct visibility of some of these, you know, fairly large student numbers that are sitting there with people who aren't on the register, I think has got to be answered. As I say, when we've been advising, you know, people want to enter the HE market, one of the challenges is regulation, you know, is difficult and expensive and challenging for small new entrants and so on. So if they do that, it would be really fascinating to see what the effect is on how many people actually want to be on the, you know, on the franchise side of it, or how many start to say, well, okay, we should then look at more around, you know, becoming our own degree awarding powers quicker than perhaps they're currently thinking about. So it would have all sorts of other effects. It might reduce the numbers wanting to do it. It might change the nature of their engagement with the sector.
And that, of course, would be a particularly pointed question, given the Public Accounts Committee pointed out that some of the people that are being franchised to had a run at being on the register and didn't make it onto the register for whatever reason. So
And you know, again, we've talked about about some of those. But for example, FE colleges, who went onto the register, they found that the, you know, so delivering HE and FE, which we all accept is a really important part of a tertiary approach, et cetera. They found, some of them, that the cost of regulation or the bureaucracy around regulation, the investment they need, meant that they couldn't continue with that model. So they were then, they're trying to move back into more of a subcontracting, approach as well. So you might lose a few important parts of, the sector that's not really the focus of this insight brief. And that's the challenge, that, you know, it isn't a one size fits all, never has been. We need to make sure that whatever we do doesn't inadvertently create other risks. The final point, Jim, I just want to say this, because we've talked about the problem with it being about individual contracts with students. We talked about the problem that individual institutions are having to make decisions, you know, about their, that are about, you know, sort of stabilizing their own financial position and so on. And what's really missing is that sort of interest of the sector overall piece. You know, who is thinking about what this is doing to the sector overall? And no individual institution has a reason to think about that, you know, but if we don't, then the damage affects everybody, you know, further down the line. So it would be good to think that there was somebody that could look out for that.
I often imagine that at Universities UK conference, in like a hall's kitchen, not that they all stay in halls these days, in a hall's kitchen, one VC is like having a pop at another saying, what are you doing? You're dragging us all down. But I assume it doesn't really work like that. Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
Okay, so I think that one of the meta themes of Wonky is how we get universities and policy stuck together. And yeah, there are whole books published on this now, which are excellent. But the best way you could possibly manage this is for universities to have their own MPs. How much fun would that be? And the good news is, for over 600 years, that's what we had. Probably need to amend that. It wasn't 600 years, it's about 400 years. So for ages, we had our own MPs. What happened was, beginning of James I and VI's reign, when he came down from Scotland, he wanted to summon a new parliament. And the university thought this was a great way of having their own MP. So Oxford and Cambridge got themselves organised. They had a discussion with the King's ministers about what the best thing to do would be. So the King's ministers wrote back and said, look, on the whole, it would be good if you didn't send the Vice-Chancellor, send us two people. And they went up to the university's governing body to decide who the two members of Parliament for the two universities would be. And so over time, what happened was that got coalesced, so people got to have a vote, because they're democratic institutions. And so slowly this became a way of getting to have MPs. And they were just normal MPs after a while. They weren't just representing the university. They just did normal things for the university. So they went through a long line of distinguished people, but not a very distinguished electoral process, because it was just down to the governing body. Everyone who had an MA could vote in it. And therefore, there was an awful lot of what you would effectively call vote rigging. King sending delegates, the chancellor of the university would nominate somebody, and it was, you know, woe betide the university didn't send them back. So curiously enough, they had one of the university chancellors of Cambridge managed to get his nephew appointed as an MP. He hadn't actually been to Cambridge, so they had to quickly make him a member of Trinity College so that he could be the MP for Cambridge. And everything went off quite happily from there. So this continues. There's a mixture of very enterprising young men who get picked to do this, and sometimes it's safe country gentlemen. And this continues happily until you get to the growth of new universities in the 19th century. And so the University of London manages to persuade Parliament it should have an MP too. And so off they go, and they set up a convocation to do that. The Scots get university MPs as well, and therefore there's a big development of this work. Come the First World War, electoral reform is on everyone's mind. And so there's a parliamentary commission, the Speaker's Commission, that sets out what we should do. And the great thing is that they decide to reform the university MPs, and they do two key things. Firstly, they let the combined universities, the new modern universities, have their own MP, and they let women vote in these elections and stand for them, because this is the same piece of legislation that lets women have the vote. They have to have a special codicil to allow Oxford and Cambridge graduates, because the women aren't allowed to be graduates yet, but they are allowed to stand in the election and vote in the election. But in the Parliamentary Commission, they thought that single transferable votes would be a good idea. So they actually had single transferable votes for MPs for the university constituencies. It was a postal vote. You got on the register. You're allowed to be on the register of different universities, but you can only vote once in a university constituency. And it was good student union style single transferable votes. And for the period between 1918 and 1948, we had single transferable vote proportional representation in the UK Parliament, but only for these university constituencies. Now, some of the people were quite distinguished who did this. There was a particularly impressive woman who became the MP for the combined universities, Eleanor Rathbone. She did all sorts of reforming things. But on the whole, there was a mixture between party political people. They weren't too independent. So come the Second World War, the Labour Party comes into power. They start to implement another Speaker's Commission after that. And they decide to go completely against pluralism. So they drop it. And there's a great exchange in Parliament with Winston Churchill, definitely laying into the Socialist Party for this terrible breach of all this historical precedent of how they'd had these wonderful people who'd been MPs for the universities, and it should continue. And Churchill swears that he will bring it back in when he gets back into power. So the Labour Party get rid of it. In the 1950 election, there are no university MPs. But strangely enough, it never gets back on the statute book. We do not have university MPs. Plenty of people might think of themselves as a university MP representing a university constituency, but we would have had a separate vote as graduates for our own MPs, an opportunity that no doubt we could try and press for in the future. Get that policy decision back into higher education. Let's have our own MPs.
Now, finally this week, JISC has a new student experience report out. And Smita, I guess the big question is the digital divide getting bigger?
Certainly, Jim, on the results of this survey, it appears to be getting worse for some students. I mean, just to recap, the digital experience survey is based on more than 28,000 responses from 40 higher education providers across the UK. Now, some good news is that overall, perceptions of what you would describe as the experience being provided by the learning experience being provided by institutions appeared positive. So 55% said learning materials were engaging and motivating, and only 3% said that their digital learning environment was below average. But that did mask a lot of other issues for students who are trying to access digital learning, and in particular, the familiar territory of certain demographic groups, certain types of students having barriers in their way because they don't have access to the same sort of quality of technology or areas to work, etc., as other students do. So it's getting worse, and as always, it's affecting people who are perhaps already disadvantaged by one characteristic or another more than it is affecting other types of students or types of provision. And it was a particularly interesting piece for me to look at because the Higher Education Commission, which I sit on, their last report was about blended learning and the importance of increasing both the quality and indeed the quantity of it in higher education. And unless we tackle the unequal impact it's having on students, if institutions do start to do more of it, we will see that, you know, it becomes exacerbated, doesn't it, that certain groups are going to have a poor quality experience. And the final point I'd make before I hand back to you, Jim, to open it up for discussion is in the conversation we've just had about finances, you know, it's all very well to say institutions should be providing laptops and they should be providing the best quality Wi-Fi and they should be providing great spaces for people to work. You know, question is, can they afford to right now? And if they can't, what does that mean? Does it we just leave it, or does somebody else step in? Is there a role for, you know, network broadband providers or something else, somebody else to kind of get involved in this space?
Now, James, that is a very interesting question, isn't it? So, you know, we often think about institutional funding and student funding in kind of two separate pots, two worlds, two budget lines, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I mean, Livia on the site, you'll have seen this week, our colleague Livia has kind of brought this out quite vividly, I think, which is, you know, if you've been told by the centre to make your kind of straight line cut,
you're going to, you know, let's say you've got 15 concurrent software licenses purchased on your program. You might cut that to 12 looking at previous usage, right? At the same time, as students face the squeeze, more of them will be thinking, well, I can't afford my own copy of that software, so I'm going to depend on the shared stuff. And slowly, a million micro decisions where the university's got to save a bit of money and students have got to save a bit of money start to clash.
Yeah.
And that clash, because Smita's right, you know, in theory, OFS says you shouldn't have to pay more for access to tech in order to succeed on your course or whatever the wording is. And, the question then becomes, are OFS's B conditions actually affordable?
I think the problem is they have to be because, you know, access to digital technologies, hardware, software, etc. is like access to a utility, particularly in a modern learning environment. You simply can't function without it. There are probably some questions on whether really software, hardware intensive programs gold plated, and you could make some reductions, but you can't really make changes to digital infrastructure without changing soft strategies about learning and teaching more generally. The other point I make, Jim, is that, you know, I feel like we've read a version of this for half a decade or more. And I know GISP did this in an annual survey, but this question of digital poverty, digital exclusion is massive. But if you look at the work that's going on in the wider public sphere, work by Lloyd suggests that 14.9 million people still have very low digital engagement. But of the people who are offline, 55% of them earn less than 20 grand a year. So digital exclusion is an economic inclusion question as well. And I think that brings to question of the money we give students who are on low incomes, bursaries, scholarships, whatever. Are we deploying them in the most effective ways possible? So I would always discourage straight line cuts and think about what is the wider institutional strategies that are leading to decisions around wider digital infrastructure.
The thing that has always struck me about them since they came in is that essentially because of capped fees, you know, regulated fees, et cetera, everybody gets the same amount of money. But the needs of some students are going to be greater than others. And you've got some institutions that are doing the, you know, the heavy lifting on taking students who maybe don't have the domestic, you know, support around or access to facilities at home, etc. No criticism of anybody for that. That is just the state. They don't get any extra money for that. And they're the ones who are then going to be penalized for not delivering it. That is not a fair system. It's absolutely not a fair system. And it's a system that kind of belies the ability of institutions to really do manage their own finances in an appropriate way, because they will need to do more with less. Yeah. It's not fair.
Because I guess to the extent to which there is funding, one, it's going down per head, that kind of top up, what we call student premium funding. Maybe I can't remember if it's still called that, but because it always used to be. That student premium funding is going down per head. But I guess to the extent to which people deploy that funding, you know, deliberately, they'll be deploying it on, you know, people or student financial support and so on. I doubt anyone sat there thinking, we need to spend a load of that on, you know, the laptops that people can't buy these days, are they?
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't think it's a fair or sustainable way of looking at it, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, Ben, I mean, this is fascinating to me, I think, because if I think about how a university must go about making savings, often if it's not a particular department closing or, people going, then it's everyone needs to make an X percent cut or whatever. And it kind of cascades down. And I don't get a sense that what people do when that kind of cascades down is they're careful about what the next cohort of students will need. Do you know what I mean? So even if people think they can make a kind of a saving to please the next layer up and the next layer up because there's a big headline target saving, it's not as if there's ever time or a process to properly assess whether or not that would be a problem for the incoming cohort, is there? Or have I got this wrong?
The GISC report, I think, gives a helpful nudge towards the interplay between physical estate and digital estate. And I think if institutions can translate that nudge to think about the interplay between physical and non-physical spaces, it might help them think about the funding implications. So I don't think it would be helpful to say, shall I triple the digital innovation budget or shall I, slash it by two thirds? what might be helpful to look at is that the interplay between how digital can drive inefficiency, who can drive efficiency in other areas. So thinking about the interplay, how many times do we, you know, really interestingly, I've heard universities starting to talk about vacant space and the cost of vacant space or low usage space. How might digital help us to understand and potentially maximize the use of space? You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think JISC is nudging exactly that sort of interplay. And interestingly, students are very aware of it. Students talk about, you know, I don't want to walk to the other side of campus to see if a space is free in the library. I want to be able to go online and find out that it's free and then book it. So again, that's an example of students demanding interplay between physical and virtual learning experiences, social experiences, etc.
And Jimbo, of course, according to Tony Blair this week, we all need to be focused on AI.
I mean, Jim, does this entire conversation I'm bringing home that AI is going to change the world in ways which I'm not qualified to even begin to understand? However, if you simply don't have access to a laptop, it all seems a bit moot to me.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Smita, Ben, James, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.